This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Just Mercy, adapted for young adults, a true story of the fight for justice. This is the author, Brian Stevenson. To all the young people I've had the privilege to represent, love is the motive, but justice is the instrument. Reinhold Niebuhr. Introduction. Higher Ground. I wasn't prepared to meet a condemned man. In 1983, I was a 23-year-old Harvard Law School student working at an internship in Georgia, eager and worried that I was in over my head. I had never seen the inside of a maximum security prison and had certainly never been to death row. Georgia's death row is in a prison outside of Jackson, a remote rural town. I drove there by myself, my heart pounding harder the closer I got. I was convinced that this man was going to be very disappointed to see me. I didn't really know anything about capital punishment and hadn't even taken a class in criminal procedure yet. I didn't have a basic grasp of the complex appeals process that shaped death penalty litigation, a process that would in time become as familiar to me as the back of my hand. I studied philosophy in college, and didn't realize until my senior year that no one would pay me to philosophize when I graduated. I was uncertain about what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew it would have something to do with the lives of the poor, America's history of racial inequality, and the struggle to be just and fair with one another. I found two programs that seemed like the right fit at Harvard. I could study law while also pursuing a graduate degree in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government. Not long after classes began, I started to worry I'd made the wrong choice. I felt less experienced than my peers. I'd never even met a lawyer before starting law school. I felt very fortunate to have been admitted, but by the end of my first year, I'd grown disenchanted. Harvard Law School was a pretty intimidating place, and the courses seemed disconnected from the race and poverty issues that had motivated me to study the law in the first place. While my classmates put on expensive suits and interviewed at firms in New York, Los Angeles, or Washington, D.C., I spent the summer after my first year in law school working with the Juvenile Justice Project in Philadelphia and taking advanced calculus courses at night to prepare for my next year at the Kennedy School. The public policy program's curriculum was extremely numbers and statistics focused, leaving me feeling adrift. Then, suddenly, everything came into focus. I discovered that the law school offered a one-month intensive course on race and poverty litigation, taught by Betsy Barthollet, who had worked as an attorney with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Students were required to spend the month with an organization doing social justice work. So in December 1983, I found myself on a plane to Atlanta, Georgia, where I was scheduled to spend a few weeks working with the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee, SPDC, now known as the Southern Center for Human Rights, or SCHR. Their mission? To defend condemned people on death row in Georgia. I met Steve Bright, the director of the SPDC, on my flight down. Steve was a brilliant trial lawyer in his mid-30s. He'd grown up on a farm in Kentucky, ended up in Washington, D.C. at the Public Defender Service, and had just been recruited to take over the SPDC. Unlike so many of my law professors, there was no disconnect between what he did and what he believed in. When we met, he warmly wrapped me in a full-body hug, and then we started talking. We didn't stop till we reached Atlanta. "Brian," he said at some point during our short flight, "capital punishment means them without the capital get the punishment. We can't help people on death row without help from people like you." I processed what he meant. People without money or capital were the ones who were punished. I was taken aback by his immediate belief that I had something to offer. He broke down the issues with the death penalty simply but persuasively, and I hung on every word, completely engaged by his dedication and charisma. It was deeply affirming to meet someone whose work so powerfully animated his life. I just hope you're not expecting anything too fancy while you're here, he said. Oh, no, I assured him. I'm grateful for the opportunity to work with you. Well, we live kind of simply, and the hours are pretty intense, he warned. I quickly realized he wasn't kidding. There were just a few attorneys working at the SPDC when I arrived that winter. In their 30s, men and women, black and white, these lawyers were prepared to fight for the rights of the condemned and those facing unjust treatment in jails and prisons. After years of prohibition and delay, executions were again taking place in the Deep South. Most of the SBDC's lawyers had come to Georgia in response to a growing crisis. Death row prisoners couldn't get lawyers and were being denied their right to receive counsel for legal advice. There was a growing fear that people would be killed without ever having their cases reviewed by skilled counsel. Every day, we got frantic calls from people who had no legal assistance but whose execution dates were on the calendar and approaching fast. I'd never heard voices so desperate. When I started my internship, everyone was extremely kind to me, and I felt immediately at home. I did clerical work, answering phones and researching legal questions for staff. I was just getting settled into my routine when Steve asked me to go to death row to meet with a condemned man who had been there for more than 2 years. My job was to convey to him one simple message: you will not be killed in the next year. Driving through farmland in rural Georgia, I rehearsed what I would say when I met this man. Hello, my name is Brian. I'm a student with the... No. I'm a law student with... No. My name is Brian Stevenson. I'm a legal intern with the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee, and I've been instructed to inform you that you will not be executed soon. You can't be executed soon. You are not at risk of execution anytime soon. No. Soon I found myself pulling up to the intimidating barbed wire fence and white guard tower of the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification State Prison, or as we called it at SPDC, Jackson. This was a hard place. When I told the visitation officer that I was a paralegal sent to meet with a death row prisoner, he looked at me suspiciously. I waited until he brusquely directed me to the small room where the visit would take place. "Don't get lost in here. We don't promise to come and find you," he warned. The visitation room was an empty metal cage. It was small, and although I knew it couldn't be true, it felt like it was getting smaller by the second. I began worrying again about my lack of preparation. I'd scheduled to meet with the client for 1 hour, but how would I fill all that time? I sat down on one of the stools that were bolted to the floor and waited anxiously. Finally, I heard the clanging of chains on the other side of the door. The man who walked in seemed even more nervous than I was. He glanced at me, his face screwed up in a worried wince. He was a young, neatly groomed African-American man with short hair, clean-shaven, medium frame and build, wearing bright, clean prison whites. He looked immediately familiar to me, like everyone I'd grown up with, friends from school, people I played sports or music with. The guard removed his handcuffs and the shackles around his ankles and then locked eyes with me and told me I had 1 hour. The officer seemed to take pleasure in our discomfort, grinning at me before turning on his heel and leaving the room. The metal door banged loudly behind him. The condemned man didn't come any closer, and I didn't know what else to do, so I walked over and offered him my hand. He shook it cautiously. We sat down, and he spoke first. "I'm Henry," he said. "I'm very sorry," were the first words I blurted out. Despite all my preparations and rehearsed remarks, I couldn't stop myself from apologizing repeatedly. "I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. Okay, I don't really know. I'm just a law student. I'm not a real lawyer. I'm so sorry. I can't tell you very much, but I don't know very much." The man looked at me worriedly. "Is everything all right with my case?" "Oh, yes, sir. The lawyers at SBDC sent me down to tell you that they don't have a lawyer yet. but you're not at risk of execution any time in the next year. We're working on finding you a lawyer, a real lawyer, and we hope a lawyer will be down to see you in the next few months. I'm just a law student. I'm really happy to help, I mean, if there's something I can do. The man interrupted my chatter by quickly grabbing my hands. I'm not going to have an execution date any time in the next year? No, sir, they said it would be at least a year before you get an execution date. Those words didn't sound very comforting to me, but Henry just squeezed my hands tighter and tighter. Thank you, man. I mean, really, thank you. This is great news. His shoulders relaxed, and he looked at me with intense relief in his eyes. You are the first person I've met in over 2 years after coming to Death Row, who is not another Death Row prisoner or Death Row guard. I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad to get this news, he exhaled loudly. I've been talking to my wife on the phone, but I haven't wanted her to come and visit me or bring the kids because I was afraid they'd show up and I'd have an execution date. I just don't want them here like that. Now I'm going to tell them they can come and visit. Thank you. I was astonished that he was so happy. I relaxed, too, and soon we were both lost in conversation. He told me about his trial. I answered his questions about law school. We talked about our families, about music, about prison. We talked about what's important in life and what's not. We laughed at times, and there were moments when he was very emotional and sad. We kept talking and talking, and it was only when I heard a loud bang on the door that I realized I'd stayed way past my allotted time for the legal visit. I looked at my watch. I'd been there 3 hours. The guard came in. He snarled at me. You should have been done a long time ago. You have to leave. He pulled Henry's hands together behind his back and locked them in handcuffs. Then he roughly shackled Henry's ankles. I could see Henry grimacing with pain. I said, I think those cuffs are on too tight. Can you loosen them, please? You don't tell me how to do my job. Henry gave me a smile and said, It's okay, Brian. Don't worry about this. Just come back and see me again, okay? I could see him wince with each click of the chains being tightened around his waist. Distraught, I mumbled, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. Don't worry about this, Brian, he said, cutting me off. Just come back. I wanted to say something reassuring, something that expressed my gratitude to him for being so patient with me and my nerves, but I couldn't think of anything. As the guard shoved him roughly toward the door, Henry looked back at me and smiled. Just before he could be pushed out the door, he planted his feet on the floor. Then he did something completely unexpected. He closed his eyes. He tilted his head back. I was confused by what he was doing, but then as he opened his mouth, I understood. He began to sing. He had a tremendous baritone voice that was strong and clear. It startled both me and the guard who stopped his pushing. I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I'm onward bound. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. It was an old hymn they used to sing all the time in the church where I grew up. I hadn't heard it in years. Henry sang slowly and with great sincerity and conviction. Because his ankles were shackled and his hands were locked behind his back, Henry almost stumbled when the guard shoved him forward again, but he kept on singing down the hall. Hearing his song was a precious gift. I'd come into the prison feeling insecure and inadequate. I had no right to expect anything from a condemned man on death row. Yet he gave me an astonishing measure of his humanity and compassion. In that moment, Henry altered something in my understanding of human potential, redemption, and hopefulness. I finished my internship committed to helping the death row prisoners I had met that month. When I returned to law school, I felt an intense desire to understand the laws that permitted and sanctioned the death penalty and other extreme punishments. I piled up courses, constitutional law, litigation, appellate procedure, and federal courts, I plunged deeply into the history of race, poverty, and power. Both law school and my public policy degree had seemed abstract and disconnected before, but after meeting the desperate and imprisoned, they both became relevant and critically important. My short time on death row revealed that there was something skewed in the way our judicial system interprets the law. The more I reflected on the experience, the more I recognized that I'd been struggling my whole life with the question of how and why some people are judged unfairly. I grew up in a poor, rural settlement on the eastern shore of the Delmarva Peninsula, in Delaware, where the racial history of this country casts a long shadow. Confederate flags, symbols of white supremacy and slavery, were proudly displayed throughout the region. African Americans lived in racially segregated ghettos, isolated by railroad tracks within small towns or in colored sections in the country. Some people lived in tiny shacks. Families without indoor plumbing had to use outhouses. We shared our outdoor play space with chickens and pigs. The black people around me were strong and determined, but marginalized and excluded. My father left the area as a teenager because there was no local high school for black children. He returned with my mother and found work in a food factory. On weekends, he did domestic work at beach cottages and rentals. My mother worked at an Air Force base. My relatives worked hard all the time but never seemed to prosper. My grandmother was the daughter of people who were enslaved in Caroline County, Virginia. She was born in the 1880s, her parents in the 1840s. Her father talked to her all the time about growing up in slavery. He had learned to read and write but kept it a secret until emancipation, that is, when he was freed. The legacy of slavery shaped my grandmother. It shaped the way she raised her 9 children. It influenced the way she talked to me, the way she constantly told me, "Keep close." When I visited her, she would hug me so tightly that I could barely breathe, but it made me happy to be wrapped in her formidable arms. "You can't understand most of the important things from a distance, Brian. You have to get close," she told me often. The distance I experienced in my first year of law school made me feel lost. Closeness to the condemned, to people unfairly judged, that was what guided me back to something that felt like home. This book is about how quickly we condemn people in this country. It is about the dramatic increase in the number of people incarcerated in America, a phenomenon known as mass incarceration. It is about extreme punishment, the harsh, excessive sentences we give to the condemned, and the sinister treatment they face once in prison. It is about how we create injustice by allowing our fear, anger, and distance to guide the way we treat those who are more vulnerable. It's also about a dramatic period in our recent history that marked the lives of millions of Americans, of all races, ages, and genders, and the country as a whole. When I first visited death row in December 1983, America was going through a radical transformation. We were imprisoning more people than any other country. Today, we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. In the early 1970s, the prison population was 300,000 people. Currently, it's 2.3 million people. Nearly 6 million people are on probation, meaning they've been released from their prison sentence but are still supervised, or on parole, meaning they've been released from their prison sentence on good behavior. 1 in every 15 people born in the United States in 2001 is expected to go to jail or prison. 1 in every 3 black male babies born in this century is expected to be incarcerated. To be clear, these numbers reflect who is being convicted and incarcerated, not who is necessarily committing crimes. We have shot, hanged, gassed, electrocuted, and lethally injected hundreds of people in the name of the law. Thousands more await their execution in the section of prisons known as death row. We've sent 250,000 kids, some under the age of 12, to adult jails and prisons. For years, we've been the only country in the world that condemns children to life imprisonment without parole. We've created laws that make nonviolent offenses like writing a bad check or committing a petty theft, result in life imprisonment. We have locked away people with substance abuse problems, with more than 500,000 people in state or federal prisons for drug offenses. We've given up on rehabilitation, education, and services for the imprisoned because providing assistance to the incarcerated is apparently too kind and compassionate. We've institutionalized policies that reduce people to their worst acts and permanently label them criminal, murderer, rapist, thief, drug dealer, sex offender, felon, identities they cannot change regardless of the circumstances of their crimes or any improvements they might try making in their lives. Mass incarceration's effects on the world outside of prisons have been equally profound. We ban poor people and their children from receiving food stamps and public housing if they have prior drug convictions, often leaving them homeless and unemployable. Some states strip people with criminal convictions of the right to vote. As a result, in several southern states, disenfranchisement among African-American men has reached levels unseen since before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which legally prohibited racial discrimination in voting. We also make terrible mistakes. Thousands of innocent people suffer in prison. Scores have been exonerated, cleared of guilt, after being sentenced to death and nearly executed. Hundreds of prisoners who are not on death row have been released after being proved innocent through DNA testing. Presumptions of guilt based on poverty and racial bias have created a system that is defined by error. Finally, we spend lots of money on prisons, nearly $80 billion every year. To cover the cost, state governments have taken away funds from public services, education, health, and welfare. In fact, private prison builders and prison service companies have paid millions of dollars to state and local governments, trying to convince them to create new crimes, impose harsher sentences, and keep more people locked up so that they can increase profits. The privatization of mass incarceration is a moneymaker for a few and a costly nightmare for the rest of us, and it has ruined efforts to improve public safety, reduce the costs of mass incarceration, and most significantly, promote rehabilitation of the incarcerated. After graduating from law school, I returned to the Deep South to represent the poor, the incarcerated, and the condemned. In the last 30 years, I've gotten close to people who have been wrongly convicted and sent to death row, people like Walter McMillan. In this book, you will learn the story of Walter's case, which shows how our legal system convicts and condemns people irresponsibly, with disturbing and traumatic results. But Walter's case also taught me something else. There is light within this darkness. Walter's story is one of many that I tell in these chapters. I've represented abused and neglected children who were prosecuted as adults and suffered more abuse and mistreatment after being placed in adult facilities. I've represented women whose numbers in prison have increased 640% in the last 30 years and seen how our hysteria about drug addiction and our hostility to the poor have made us quick to criminalize them. I've represented mentally disabled people whose illnesses have landed them in prison for decades. I've gotten close to victims of violent crime and their families, and witnessed how mass imprisonment has even made prison staff more violent and angry and less just and merciful. I've also represented people who have committed terrible crimes, but nonetheless strive to recover and to find redemption. I have discovered, deep in the hearts of many condemned and incarcerated people, seeds of hope and humanity that come to astonishing life when nurtured by very simple acts of care and respect. My work has taught me a vital lesson. Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I am persuaded that the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. Finally, I've come to believe that the true measure of our commitment to justice, fairness, and equality cannot be measured by how we treat the rich, the respected, and the privileged among us. The true measure of our character is how we treat the poor, the disfavored, the accused, the incarcerated, and the condemned. We are all implicated when we allow other people to be mistreated. An absence of compassion can corrupt the decency of a community, a state, an entire nation. Fear and anger can make us cruel and abusive. We all suffer from the absence of mercy, and we harm ourselves as much as we victimize others. The closer we get to mass incarceration and extreme levels of punishment, the more I believe it's necessary to recognize that we all need mercy, we all need justice, and perhaps we all need some measure of unmerited grace. Chapter 1. Mockingbird Players. I was in my late 20s and about to start my fourth year at the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee, SPDC, when I met Walter McMillan. His case was one of the many I was trying frantically to keep up with. After all, a crisis was growing. Alabama had no public defender system, which meant that many death row prisoners didn't have lawyers to represent them. My friend, Eva Ansley, was at an Alabama prison project to track cases and match lawyers to prisoners. In 1988, we got federal funding to create a legal center that could represent people on death row. I'd already worked on lots of death penalty cases in several southern states, sometimes winning a stay which puts a stop to the execution just minutes before an electrocution was scheduled. When I'd last visited death row, I met with five desperate condemned men: Willie Tabb, Vernon Madison, Jesse Morrison, Harry Nix, and Walter McMillan. The most memorable thing about Walter was how insistent he was that he'd been wrongly convicted. "Mr. Bryan, I know it may not matter to you, but it's important to me that you know that I'm innocent and didn't do what they said I did, not no kind of way," he told me in the meeting room. His voice was level but laced with emotion. I nodded. I'd learned to accept what clients tell me until the facts suggest something else. "I'm sure I'm not the first person on death row to tell you that they're innocent, but I really need you to believe me. My life has been ruined. This lie they put on me is more than I can bear, and if I don't get help from someone who believes me..." His lip began to quiver, and he clenched his fists to stop himself from crying. "I'm sorry. I know you'll do everything you can to help me," he said, his voice quieter. My instinct was to comfort him. His pain seemed so sincere. There wasn't much I could do, but I reassured him that I would look at everything carefully. Back at the office, I went through the mound of records until I found the transcripts from Walter McMillan's trial. The trial had been short. I started reading. Walter McMillan was at least 15 years older than me, not particularly well-educated, and he hailed from a small rural community. Though he had lived in Monroe County his whole life, he had never heard of the author Harper Lee, also a Monroeville, Alabama native, or her award-winning novel To Kill a Mockingbird. Mockingbird tells the story of an innocent black man who is accused of raping a white woman in the 1930s and is bravely defended by Atticus Finch, a white lawyer. What is often overlooked is that the black man falsely accused in the story was not successfully defended by Atticus. Tom Robinson, the wrongly accused black defendant, is found guilty. Later he dies when, full of despair, he makes a desperate attempt to escape from prison. He is shot 17 times in the back by his captors. While the novel captivated millions of readers and confronted them with some of the realities of race and justice in the South, its harder truths did not take root. Walter McMillan, like the character Tom Robinson, grew up in one of several poor black settlements outside of Monroeville, where he worked the fields with his family before he was old enough to attend school. Educational opportunities for black children in the 1950s were limited, but Walter's mother got him to the dilapidated colored school for a couple of years when he was young. By the time he was 8 or 9, though, he became too valuable for plowing, planting, and picking cotton to justify the remote advantages of continuing school. Some backstory about Walter's hometown. Monroe County had been developed by plantation owners in the 19th century for the production of cotton. The fertile, rich, black soil of the area attracted white settlers from the Carolinas, who amassed plantations and a huge slave population. Even decades after the Civil War and emancipation, the African-American population toiled in the fields of the Black Belt as sharecroppers and tenant farmers, dependent on white landowners for survival. By the 1950s, small cotton farming was replaced with timber farming as Alabama's thriving industry. White landowners opened pulp and paper mills across the region. Acres and acres of land were converted to growing pine trees for paper mills and industrial uses. Times were changing, for better and for worse. African Americans, largely excluded from this new paper industry, found themselves confronting new economic challenges even as they won basic civil rights. The brutal era of sharecropping and Jim Crow was ending, but what followed was persistent unemployment and worsening poverty. The region's counties remained some of the poorest in America. Walter started his own pulpwood business in the 1970s. He smartly and bravely borrowed money to buy his own power saw, tractor, and pulpwood truck. By the 1980s, he had developed a solid business that didn't make much extra money but afforded him something else he valued, independence. If he had worked at the mill or the factory, the kind of job that most poor Black Alabamians worked, it would mean working for white business owners and dealing with the racial stress that that implied in 1970s and 1980s Alabama. Walter couldn't escape the reality of racism, but having his own business gave him a flexibility that many African Americans did not enjoy. Walter's independence won him respect and admiration, but it also sparked contempt and suspicion. His freedom was, to some of the white people in town, well beyond what African Americans with limited education could achieve through legitimate means. Still, he was pleasant, respectful, generous, and accommodating, which made him well liked by the people, Black or white, with whom he did business. Like anyone, Walter had his flaws. Though he and his wife Minnie had three children, it was well known that he was romantically involved with other women. Tree work is notoriously demanding and dangerous. With few ordinary comforts in his life, the attention of women was something Walter did not easily resist. There was something about his rugged exterior, his long, bushy hair and uneven beard, combined with his generous and charming nature, that attracted the attention of some women. Walter grew up understanding that it was forbidden for a Black man to be intimate with a white woman. He didn't initially think much of the flirtations of Karen Kelly, a young white woman he'd met at the Waffle House where he ate breakfast. She was attractive, but he didn't take her too seriously. When her flirtations became more explicit, Walter hesitated, and then persuaded himself no one would know. After a few weeks, it became clear that his relationship with Karen was trouble. She was younger and married. As word got around that the two were friends, she seemed to take a mischievous pride in her intimacy with Walter. When her husband Joe found out, things quickly turned ugly. Karen and Joe had been unhappy and were already planning to divorce. Now, Joe was threatening to take custody of their children and to disgrace her by exposing her relationship with a Black man. Soon enough, Walter received a subpoena summoning him to testify at a hearing about the Kellys' custody battle. He knew it was going to cause him serious problems. Nervously, he went to the courthouse. When Walter took the stand, the lawyer for Joe Kelly's husband asked him crude, hostile questions. Walter wanted to forget about the whole ordeal, but word of the interracial affair spread quickly, and his reputation shifted. No longer the hard-working pulpwood man, known to white people almost exclusively for what he could do with a saw in the pine trees, Walter now represented something more threatening in their eyes. Fears of interracial sex and marriage have deep roots in the United States. In the aftermath of slavery, the creation of a system of racial hierarchy and segregation was largely designed to prevent relationships like Walter and Karen's. In fact, interracial relationships were legally prohibited by anti-miscegenation statutes. The word miscegenation came into use in the 1860s when supporters of slavery coined the term to promote the fear of interracial sex in marriage and the race mixing that would result if slavery was abolished. For over a century, many Southern law enforcement officials saw it as part of their duty to punish black men who had been intimate with their white women. The federal government had promised racial equality to freed former slaves during the short period of Reconstruction. But after federal troops left Alabama in the 1870s, white supremacy swiftly returned, and a series of racially restrictive laws enforced the subordination of African Americans. Voting rights were taken away. Interracial sex and marriage were criminalized, and states throughout the South used the anti-miscegenation laws to justify the forced sterilization of poor and minority women. Forbidding sex between white women and black men became an intense preoccupation throughout the South. In 1882, the Alabama Supreme Court reviewed a case regarding an affair between Tony Pace, an African-American man, and Mary Cox, a white woman. Both received prison terms. The following year, the United States Supreme Court reviewed the Alabama court's decision, using separate but equal language, just as the Plessy versus Ferguson case would 20 years later. The court unanimously upheld Alabama's ban on interracial sex and marriage. Following the court's decision, many Southern and Midwestern states passed racial integrity laws that made it illegal for African Americans and sometimes Native Americans and Asian Americans to marry or have sex with white people. It wasn't until 1967 that the United States Supreme Court finally struck down anti-miscegenation statutes in Loving versus Virginia. But restrictions on interracial marriage persisted even after that landmark ruling. It was only in 2000 that the issue got on Alabama's statewide ballot, where a majority of voters chose to eliminate the ban, although 41% still voted to keep it. Occasionally drinking too much, getting into a fight, or even having an extramarital affair, these slip-ups weren't significant enough to destroy the reputation and standing of an honest and industrious black man. But interracial dating, particularly with a married white woman, was for many whites a transgression in its own unique category of danger, with correspondingly extreme punishments. Hundreds of black men have been lynched for even unsubstantiated suggestions of such intimacy. Walter may not have known the legal history, but like every black man in Alabama, he knew deep in his bones the perils of interracial romance for black men. Nearly a dozen people had been lynched in Monroe County, and dozens of additional lynchings had taken place in neighboring counties. These lynchings were acts of terror, inspiring fear that any encounter with a white person, any social misstep, any unintended slight, any ill-advised look or comment could trigger a gruesome, even deadly attack. Walter had heard his parents and relatives talk about lynchings when he was a young child. When he was 12, the body of Russell Charlie, a black man from Monroe County who was reputed to have had an interracial romance, was found hanging from a tree in Vredenburgh, Alabama. Walter remembered well the terror that shot through the black community in Monroe County when Charlie's lifeless, bullet-ridden body was found swinging in a tree. And now it seemed to Walter that everyone in Monroe County was talking about his own relationship with Karen Kelly. It worried him in a way that few things ever had. A few weeks later, an even more unthinkable act shocked Monroeville. In the late morning of November 1, 1986, Rhonda Morrison, a white, 18-year-old college student and the beautiful young daughter of a respected local family, was found shot dead on the floor of Monroe Cleaners, the shop where she had worked. Murder was uncommon in Monroeville. The death of young Rhonda was a crime unlike anything the community had ever experienced. She was popular, an only child, and the kind of girl whom the entire white community embraced as a daughter. The police initially believed that no one from the community, black or white, would have done something so horrific. They pursued two Latino men who had been spotted in Monroeville, looking for work the day Rhonda Morrison's body was found. Police tracked the suspects down in Florida but found that they could not have committed the murder. The former owner of the cleaners, an older white man named Miles Jackson, fell under suspicion, but there was no evidence that pointed to him as a killer. The current owner of the cleaners, Rick Blair, was questioned but considered an unlikely suspect. Within a few weeks, the police had tapped out their leads. People in Monroe County began to whisper about the incompetence of the police. Why couldn't they even find a suspect, people murmured. Tom Tate was elected the new county sheriff days after the murder took place, and folks started to question whether he was up to the job. After all, a murderer was on the loose. Meanwhile, Walter was wrestling with his own problems. He had been trying to end his relationship with Karen Kelly. The child custody proceedings and public scandal had taken a toll on her. She had started using drugs and seemed to fall apart. She began to associate with Ralph Myers, a white man with a badly disfigured face and lengthy criminal record. The relationship with Myers brought Karen to rock bottom. Together they became involved in dealing drugs. They were also implicated in another surprising crime, the murder of Vicki Lynn Pittman, a young woman from neighboring Escambia County. While the death of Vicki Pittman was news, it failed to compare with the continuing mystery surrounding the death of Rhonda Morrison. Vicki came from a poor white family, several of whose members were incarcerated. It was as if her lower social standing caused her life and her death to be seen as less valuable than Rhonda Morrison's. Police quickly concluded that Ralph Myers had been involved in the Pittman murder. When the police interrogated him, they encountered a man as psychologically complicated as he was physically scarred. Emotional and frail, Ralph craved attention. His skills lay in manipulation and misdirection. He believed that everything he said had to be epic, shocking, and elaborate. As a child living in foster care, he had been horribly burned in a fire. The burn so scarred and disfigured his face and neck that he needed multiple surgeries to regain basic functioning. He'd grown used to strangers staring and wincing at his scars. He was a tragic outcast who lived on the margins. So he tried to compensate by pretending to have inside knowledge about all sorts of mysteries. Myers eventually admitted that he may have played an accidental role in Pittman's death, but quickly put the blame for the murder itself on others. The more he talked, the less believable his story sounded. Officials began to suspect that Myers was the only killer and was desperately trying to cover his tracks. Ralph Myers was illiterate, but he knew it was the Morrison crime that was preoccupying investigators. He changed his story again. This time, he told investigators that he had been involved in the murder of Vicki Pittman, along with Karen Kelly and her black boyfriend, Walter McMillan. But that wasn't all. He also told police that McMillan was responsible for the murder of Rhonda Morrison, too. That assertion got the attention of law enforcement officials, who were eager to pin the murder on someone. To see whether Ralph Myers and Walter McMillan were actually in cahoots, an ABI, Alabama Bureau of Investigation, agent, asked Myers to meet Mr. McMillan at a store. Agents would monitor the encounter. Watching from afar, the test would be whether the two men recognized each other. Once Myers entered the store, he was not able to identify Walter McMillan. He had to ask the owner of the store to point Mr. McMillan out. He then delivered a note to Mr. McMillan, supposedly written by Karen Kelly. According to witnesses, Walter seemed confused both by Myers, a man he had never seen before, and the note itself. Walter threw the note away and went back to what he was doing. He paid little attention to the whole odd encounter. The ABI agents were left with plenty of evidence indicating that the two men had never met, let alone committed murders together. Still, they persisted with the McMillan theory. Time was passing, 7 months by now, and the community was fearful and angry. They desperately needed an arrest. Monroe County Sheriff Tom Tate did not have much law enforcement experience. Now, 4 months into his term as sheriff, he faced a seemingly unsolvable murder and intense public pressure. But there was no evidence against Mr. McMillan. No evidence except that he was an African-American man involved in an adulterous interracial affair, which meant he was reckless and possibly dangerous, even if he had no prior criminal history and a good reputation. Maybe that was evidence enough. Chapter 2. Stand. My $14,000 annual salary didn't leave me with much money for rent in Atlanta, so Steve Bright kindly took me in. Each day we dissected big and small issues from morning until midnight. I loved learning from him. After spending the first year and a half of my legal career sleeping on his living room couch, though, it was time to find an apartment of my own. When a law school classmate, Charles Bliss, moved to Atlanta, we realized we could pool our tiny salaries and afford a low-rent apartment. He was a white kid from North Carolina whom I'd grown close to in school. When work and lessons got overwhelming, we'd frequently retreat to the school gym to play basketball and to try to make sense of it all. Eventually, Charlie and I shared a two-bedroom apartment in Midtown Atlanta. Because of my growing caseload in Alabama, I didn't get to spend much time there. My plan for a new law project to represent people on death row in Alabama was starting to take shape. My hope was to get the project off the ground in Alabama and eventually return to Atlanta to live. My docket of new death penalty cases in Alabama meant I was working insane hours, driving back and forth, and simultaneously trying to resolve several prison condition cases. Conditions of confinement for prisoners were getting worse everywhere. In the 1970s, the Attica prison riots drew national attention to horrible prison abuses. Inmates took over the Attica correctional facility, and news coverage of the revolt exposed Americans to the cruel practices within prisons. In solitary confinement, for example, inmates would be isolated in a small confined space for weeks or months at a time. Prisoners in some facilities would be placed in a sweat box, a casket-sized hole or a box situated where the inmate would be forced to endure extreme heat for days or weeks. Some prisoners were tortured with electric cattle prods as punishment for violations of the prison's rule. Inmates at some facilities would be chained to hitching posts, their arms fastened above their heads in a painful position in which they'd be forced to stand for hours. The practice, which wasn't declared unconstitutional until 2002, was one of many degrading and dangerous punishments imposed on incarcerated people. Terrible food and living conditions were widespread. We were getting scores of letters from prisoners who continued to report horrible conditions. Prisoners reported that they were still being beaten by correctional staff and subjected to degrading punishments. An alarming number of cases came to us involving prisoners who had been found dead in their cells. I was working on several of these cases, including one in Gadsden, Alabama, where jail officials claimed that a 39-year-old black man had died of natural causes after being arrested for traffic violations. His family maintained that he was beaten by police and jail officials who then denied him his asthma inhaler and medication despite his begging for it. I'd spent a lot of time with the grief-stricken family, Loretta Ruffin, and heard what an affectionate father he had been, how kind he had been, and how people had made cruel assumptions about him because he was a black man at 6 feet 5 inches tall and over 250 pounds. His wife and mother recalled how sweet and gentle he had been. Gadsden police had stopped Mr. Ruffin one night because they said his car was swerving. Police discovered that his license had expired a few weeks earlier, so he was taken into custody. When he arrived at the city jail badly bruised and bleeding, Mr. Ruffin told the other inmates he had been beaten terribly and was desperately in need of his inhaler and asthma medication. When I started investigating the case, inmates at the jail told me they saw officers beating Mr. Ruffin before taking him to an isolation cell. Several hours later, they saw medical personnel remove his body from the cell on a gurney. Despite the reforms of the 1970s and early 1980s, inmate death in jails and prisons was still a serious problem. Suicide, prisoner-on-prisoner violence, inadequate medical care, staff abuse, and guard violence claimed the lives of hundreds of prisoners every year. I soon received other complaints from people in the Gadsden community. The parents of a black teenager who had been shot and killed by police told me that their son had been stopped for a minor traffic violation after running a red light. Their young son had just started driving and became very nervous when the police officer approached him. His family maintained that he reached down to the floor where he kept his gym bag to retrieve his newly issued driver's license. The police claimed he was reaching for a weapon. No weapon was found, and the teen was shot dead while he sat in his car. The officer who shot the boy said that the teen had been menacing and had moved quickly in a threatening manner. The child's parents told me their son was generally nervous and easily frightened, but was also obedient, very religious, and a good student. He would never have hurt anyone. The family persuaded civil rights leaders to push for an investigation into his death. Their pleas reached our office, and I was looking into the case along with the jail and prison cases. Figuring out Alabama civil and criminal law while managing death penalty cases in several other states kept me very busy, with long-distance driving and extremely long hours. My weathered 1975 Honda Civic was struggling to keep up. The radio had stopped working consistently a year earlier. It would come to life only if I hit a pothole or stopped suddenly enough to shake the car and spark a connection. After I made the 3-hour drive back from Gadsden early one day and heading straight to the office, it was once again approaching midnight as I left the office for home. I got in my car, and to my delight, the radio came on as soon as I turned the ignition. It was a small thing, but it made my day. Better yet, the station was playing a retrospective on the music of Sly and the Family Stone. I'd grown up listening to Sly and found myself rolling joyfully through the streets of Atlanta to tunes like Dance to the Music and Family Affair. Our midtown Atlanta apartment was on a dense residential street. Tonight, I was lucky. I found a parking spot steps from our new front door just as Sly was starting Hot Fun in the Summertime. I needed to get to bed, but the moment was too good to let pass, so I remained in the car listening. Each time a tune ended, I told myself to go inside, but then another irresistible song would begin, and I would find myself unable to leave. Stand, the soaring Sly anthem with the great gospel-themed ending, was playing when I saw a flashing police light approaching. Our section of the street ran only one way. My parked car was facing in the proper direction. The police car had come down the street in the wrong direction. I noticed for the first time that it wasn't an ordinary police cruiser, but one of the special Atlanta SWAT cars. The officers had a spotlight attached to their vehicle, and they directed it at me sitting in my car. Only then did it occur to me that they might be there for me, but I couldn't imagine why. I had been parked on the street for about 15 minutes listening to Sly. Only one of my car speakers worked, and not very well. I knew the music was quiet. The officers sat there with their light pointed at me for a minute or so. I turned off the radio. I had case files on my car seat about Loretta Ruffin and the young man who had been shot in Gadsden. Eventually, two officers got out of their vehicle. I noticed immediately that they weren't wearing the standard Atlanta police uniform. Instead, they were ominously dressed in military-style black boots with black pants and vests. It was time to get out of my car and go home. As soon as I opened the door and got out, the police officer who had started walking toward my vehicle drew his weapon and pointed it at me. My first instinct was to run. I quickly decided that wouldn't be smart. I must have looked completely bewildered. "Move and I'll blow your head off." The officer shouted the words, but I couldn't make any sense of them. I tried to stay calm. It was the first time in my life anyone had ever pointed a gun at me. "Put your hands up!" The officer was a white man about my height. In the darkness, I could only make out his black uniform and his pointed weapon. I put my hands up and noticed that he seemed nervous. I don't remember deciding to speak. I just remember the words coming out. "It's all right. It's okay." I'm sure I sounded afraid because I was terrified. I kept saying the words over and over again. "It's okay. It's okay." Finally, I said, "I live here. This is my apartment." I looked at the officer who was pointing the gun at my head less than 15 feet away. I thought I saw his hands shaking. I kept saying as calmly as I could, "It's okay, it's okay." The second officer, who had not drawn his weapon, inched cautiously toward me. He circled behind my parked car and he came up behind me. He grabbed me by the arms and pushed me up against the back of my car. The other officer then lowered his weapon. "What are you doing out here?" said the second officer, who seemed older than the one who had drawn his weapon. He sounded angry. "I live here. I moved into that house down the street just a few months ago. My roommate is inside. You can go ask him." I hated how afraid I sounded and the way my voice was shaking. "What are you doing out in the street?" "I was just listening to the radio." He placed my hands on the car and bent me over the back of the vehicle. The SWAT car's bright spotlight shone on me. I noticed people up the block turning on their lights and peering outside. The house next to ours came to life, and a middle-aged white couple walked outside and stared. The officer holding me asked me for my driver's license, but wouldn't let me move my arms to retrieve it. I told him that it was in my back pocket, and he fished my wallet from my pants. The other officer was now leaning inside my car and going through my papers. I knew that he was conducting an illegal search. I was about to say something when I saw him open the glove compartment. Opening objects in a parked vehicle was so incredibly illegal that I realized he wasn't paying any attention to the rules, so saying something about it would be pointless. There was nothing interesting in my car. No drugs, no alcohol, not even tobacco. I kept a giant-sized bag of peanut M&Ms and bazooka bubblegum in the glove compartment to help stave off hunger when I didn't have time for a meal. There were just a few M&Ms left in the bag, which the officer inspected carefully. He put his nose into the bag before tossing it back. I wouldn't be eating those M&Ms. I had not lived at our new address long enough to get a new driver's license, so the address on my license didn't match the new location. There was no legal requirement to update the driver's license, but it prompted the officer to hold me there for another 10 minutes while he went back to his car to run a search on me. Even though it was late, neighbors were coming out of their homes to watch and comment. One older white woman loudly demanded that I be questioned about items she was missing. "Ask him about my radio, my vacuum cleaner." I kept hoping that my apartment light would come on and that Charlie would walk outside and help me out. But it occurred to me he might be at his girlfriend's place. Finally, the officer returned and spoke to his partner. "They don't have anything on him." He sounded disappointed. I found my nerve and took my hands off the car. "This is so messed up. I live here. You shouldn't have done this. Why did you do this?" The older officer frowned at me. "Someone called about a suspected burglar. There have been a lot of burglaries in this neighborhood." Then he grinned. "We're going to let you go. You should be happy," he said. With that, they got in their SWAT car and drove off. The neighbors looked me over one last time before retreating back into their homes. I gathered up my papers, which the cop had scattered all over the car and onto the sidewalk. I unhappily threw my M&Ms into a trash can on the street and then walked into my apartment. To my great relief, Charlie was there. I woke him to tell the story. "They never even apologized," I kept saying. Charlie shared my outrage but soon fell back asleep. I couldn't sleep at all. When I told Steve about the incident, he was furious and urged me to file a complaint with the Atlanta Police Department. Some folks said I should explain that I was a civil rights attorney working on police misconduct cases. But why, I wondered, should someone have to explain their professional